The many waves of feminism that have emerged over the past decades demonstrate an ability to adapt, to grow, to become more and more inclusive, and to recognize diversity and pluralism. Is it any surprise that feminist studies and food studies should have become such remarkable allies? Fists in the air for justice, for equality, for care, and for labor. Welcome to Digesting Food Studies, the podcast that centers itself on food systems and food studies while also recognizing that no discipline is an island. Yeah, that's it. I'm your host and child of the second wave, David Santo. This episode focuses on the intersections of feminist studies and food studies and the ways in which both can nurture and empower the other. Appropriately, it's a lot more polyvocal than usual, and so we run slightly longer than a regular show. Instead of a single article, we focus on Volume 5, Number 1 of Canadian Food Studies, our themed issue about feminist food studies, published in February 2018. Alexia Moyer's Amuse-Bouche segment launches this episode with a female gaze into the past and a very revealing recipe for slow-cooked rice pudding from a best-selling cookbook that appeared in 1877. I then talk with the triumvirate of Jennifer Brady, Barbara Parker, and Elaine Power, three of the guest editors of this issue of CFS. In the aftertaste, and in keeping with the principle of inclusion and diversity, two students respond to articles from the issue. First, Liz Lovell considers Waste Management as Food Work by Carly Fraser and Kate Parizeau, and then Steph Chartrand discusses Leslie Frank's piece, Finding Formula. Though both food waste and formula challenges have been discussed on the show in the past, these two responses add new perspectives to both. Always a good thing when it comes to food and feminism. Well, faithful listeners, it is once again time to titillate your mental taste buds with an amuse-bouche. This week we're talking about feminist food studies and the ways that feminist studies and food studies intersect and play and work with each other. But before we get into that, Alexia is here once again to tell us about something juicy and tasteful that will make us think about feminism and the history, perhaps, also of feminist studies and food studies, maybe a bit differently, yeah?
I have a recipe for you today.
A recipe?
Yes.
How old is it?
It's 150 years old.
Okay, so we're going back a bit.
Yeah, it's a Canadian recipe. Mm-hmm. And it's for rice pudding without eggs, one should specify.
Yes.
And I'm going to read it to you. It's four lines long.
Great.
And we'll see if you can make it afterward. So it requires 2 quarts of milk, half a teacup of rice, a little less than a teacup of sugar, the same quantity of raisins, a teaspoon of cinnamon and allspice. Wash the rice, put it in with the rest of the ingredients into the milk, bake rather slowly from 2 to 3 hours, stir 2 or 3 times in the first hour of baking. If properly done, this pudding is delicious.
And if improperly done, this pudding burns onto your pan. Wow, 2 to 3 hours of baked milk. So this is turning it into kind of a caramelized milk custard with a little bit of rice in it.
I should give you a bit of background because this will help you understand this kind of recipe. The first is that it comes from the Home Cookbook, which was published in 1877. And it is our first community cookbook published in Canada.
Oh.
And it was compiled by recipes contributed by the ladies of Toronto and other towns, though these are not specified. And it was a fundraiser for the Hospital for Sick Children. This book was reissued at its 125th anniversary, actually, by Elizabeth Driver.
The great cookbook and food historian.
Exactly. So we're in good hands with Elizabeth Driver. And she kind of walks us through in the prefatory materials by telling us that the cooks in this cookbook are working with teacups because the standardized cup measurements didn't come until the 20th century.
Okay, so the whole sort of scientization of recipes is very much, well, surprise, surprise, a modern invention.
Yes. So other things that you're hearing, for instance, there are no temperatures mentioned. Mm-hmm. That's because these cooks are using fire.
Wood ovens, or, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And it also assumes that the cook has a fair amount of experience.
This is not a TikTok video for an 18-year-old learning how to make something for the first time.
Exactly. And that's why you have these vague instructions like from 2 to 3 hours. You're expected to use your own common sense.
And it also assumes that you're probably in that kitchen for an awful lot of those 2 to 3 hours. You're not going off to your computer to do a Zoom call in between. You're paying attention.
And the question is, why would you read or want to use a recipe like this? And one of the reasons, it comes from Diane Tai, who wrote a book called Baking as Biography, and is published by McGill Queen's University Press. And she reminds us that many women did not leave much in the way of a written record. And so by reading these recipes, both their text and their subtext, we can develop an understanding of the context in which they are written, the cultural conventions, the social networks, the social restrictions, the foodways. Many of these women wrote, they amended, and they collected recipes, and we can catch glimpses, and sometimes more than glimpses, of their lives from them.
So although there wasn't a formalized thing called food studies, nor certainly feminist food studies, there were women documenting from a feminist or a female perspective what's going on with day-to-day foodways. And also, as you say, there's the subtext that indicates some of those perspectives that, while not formalized as feminist studies, are necessarily kind of an early form of feminist documentation, feminist history making.
Yes, and then seen as such in the sort of early 2000s, into 2005, 2010, where they're being taken up by folklorists, by literary scholars, by philosophers, and who are suddenly looking at these things from a different angle. And so just to give you a little example of how that works, we have the title, it's Rice Pudding Without Eggs, but just underneath we have Mrs. C.H. Wheeler and Others. And that is interesting. First of all, and others, what would that suggest?
Collaboration, collectivism, communitarianism.
Yes. And that also perhaps many people would have sent the same recipes in. A community cookbook is a really interesting example to study in particular, because more than any other kind of cookbook, which is often aspirational, a community cookbook is really tried and tested. It really reflects the lived realities of the people who wrote to them.
And community cookbooks have served so many different purposes as well. So they come from places, but they also go to places. And then they're also considered, oh, they're undervalued. They're considered ephemeral. They're considered not important. And yet, as you're saying, they embed an enormous amount of somewhat coded or hidden history.
And this is a community cookbook that had a huge audience at a time when the population of Canada was 4 million. They sold 100,000 copies.
What?
And so it was a huge success. And it was a test to see that you could actually raise a lot of money in this way.
That's astounding.
Yeah.
100,000 copies when the population of Canada, let alone the population of Toronto, was not, wow.
And they continued to publish it until 1929.
It's an early joy of cooking.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
What I found interesting about going through this book is the naming of the women is quite varied. So it seems to be self-selecting. So sometimes you have initials and it could be the husband's initials. Sometimes there's this honorific title and a last name like Mrs. Arthur. Sometimes there's the honorific title of Mrs. followed by the husband's name. So Mrs. Ira Metcalf. Sometimes we have just an initial, M. And very rarely, there's a few examples, there's a first name and a last name. So Sarah Page.
Wow. So though they were authors, and even though they were best-selling authors, they were not often known under their own names.
Yes. And as interesting is the fact that there is not one model that's been imposed on it, editorially speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's the managing editor of that cookbook, I'd like to know.
Yes. The other thing that is interesting about reading recipes is that it's not limited to women for whom cooking is a joy. This is something that we learned from Diane Tai's Baking as Biography. She wrote about her mother from her mother's collection of 350 recipes that were collected in a tin, and they were on recipe cards and scraps of paper. But she notes more than once that Lorene Tai, her mother, did not like to bake, did not consciously choose to define herself through her baking, and would not want to be read through her recipes. So the stories that emerge are nonetheless rich and telling. But then we ask, what are the limits of writing recipes? Not just for learning how to cook, but preserving the memory of the person behind the recipes. Luce Girard, she's writing in The Practice of Everyday Life, Volume 2, Living and Cooking. She finds that preserving knowledge and what she calls a fragmentary yet tenacious memory of your life is actually less effective with words. And she has more faith in what she calls gestures or body techniques that are transmitted from cook to cook and from generation to generation.
So the performed aspect of cooking rather than the written aspect of cooking.
Yeah, she writes it really beautifully here. She says, "The sophisticated ritualization of basic gestures has thus become more dear to me than the persistence of words and text, because body techniques seem better protected from the superficiality of fashion. And also, a more profound and heavier material faithfulness is at play there, a way of being in the world and making it one's home." So there's two key words here. We're talking about a faithfulness and a tenaciousness of how best to record and transmit a life's work.
Well, if there's a better intro to a longer conversation about contemporary feminist food studies, I don't know what it would be. Thank you so much.
Jennifer Brady, Barbara Parker, and Elaine Power have been thinking and doing feminist food studies for numerous years, contributing broadly to journals, books, pedagogy, research, the arts, conferences, and amazing conversations. Their book, Feminist Food Studies: Intersectional Perspectives, was published in 2019 and is a smorgasbord of writings much like the issue of Canadian Food Studies that they co-edited.
Well, Barb and Elaine and Jenna, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I feel like I'm not much of a sports guy, but I do feel like we've got the dream team here of feminist food studies. I am so grateful to you all. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Let's just dive back in time. This themed issue actually came out in Canadian Food Studies in 2018, semi-early in the history of our journal, 5 years ago, and it approached the concept of the merging or the coalescing or the combination of the intersections of feminist studies and food studies to propose effectively feminist food studies. And I'm just wondering if any or all of you would like to comment on why that was an appropriate blending of ideas, theories, methods, frameworks.
Do you want to jump in, Barb?
Yeah, well, I would just say that I think it came together at that time because there was so much conversation and critique of food studies in the sense of the missing gender analysis. And so feminist food studies was first formulated as an idea, a more concrete idea, around 2005 with scholars like Avakian. Avakian had written a book, Feminist Food Studies, in 2005, and this idea of thinking about gender more constructively in terms of food and food studies sort of just blossomed around the time of 2015-16 for us in Canada with the conference, the Canadian Food Studies Conference that had happened. So Elaine, Jenna, and I came together. And so from the get-go, really, we were interested in thinking about food from an intersectional perspective, which really just involves centering conversations and critical analyses of power in relation to how we think about not just food consumption, food production, all things food, really, food practices. And there had been many key pieces that were sort of, again, engaging with these ideas.
Yeah, well, and it's an incredibly rich issue. I'm just thinking, you know, we have perspectives on technologies from an ecofeminist perspective. We have a discussion of faux meat and veganism. We've got food security, infant food security, and more generally, family food security, waste management, agroecological processes. Like, there's so many different themes that either use a feminist lens or understand gender in different ways in those different fields. And it really, it's constructed, for me personally, a whole new perspective on how to think about even the frameworks, the epistemic frameworks of how we make food studies knowledge. I mean, Jenna, I remember you and me talking about race, class, and gender. It was a combination of words that resonated over and over for me, largely through those conversations that you and I had, that I started to think about my own work differently. But is that still something that you think is missing from food studies, or is it creeping in, perhaps thanks to some of the work that you three have done on this journal?
Yeah, I mean, I think race, class, gender has always been the core. Those sort of acts of analysis have always been at the core of feminist scholarship, you know, more and more with intersectionality being such a predominant idea and feminist scholarship that certainly branched beyond race, class, and gender, as it should. So weight bias, weight stigma, for example, sexuality. And I think that that's, as Barb said, maybe not been so central to food studies in Canada. And I think for me, it's been a matter of that should have always been in food studies. I mean, I can't think of anything more relevant than those things, at least in my own work. Those themes that you mentioned that were in the special issue, but really all food touches food, food production, waste, distribution, preparation, everything is connected to issues of power.
And I mean, speaking of power, Elaine Power, let's hear from you. Sorry. You also, as one of the founding members of CAFS, have seen CAFS and the journal evolve greatly over the years. If CAFS came around as an institution around 2005, and the journal then started emerging around, well, 2013 is when we founded it, 2014 when it was published for the first time, and then 2018, we come along with this themed issue on feminist food studies. What's your perspective on how food studies has been evolving to incorporate more intersectional perspectives and perhaps some less masculist or more relational methods or theory packages?
Oh, thanks, David. I went back and looked at the special issue. 2018 seems like a lifetime ago now, I think. Mm-hmm. COVID kind of created this big black hole into which a lot of things fell.
For sure.
Yeah. I was really inspired when I went back and read it. We actually talk in the introduction to the special issue about the joint CAVS Agriculture Food and Human Values Society and the Association for Food and Society that happened at U of T in 2016, and how there was a whole day of feminist food studies presentations, which was a first for us, and how that kind of whetted our appetite for more. One of the things that struck me as I went back and looked at the special issue is that we were centering, you know, gender, race, and class. But in the meantime, I'm really struck by how much farther we've come in actually a really short time. So we talked about Avakian and Haber volume from 2005, which was the first time that that term feminist food studies was coined, and building on Arlene Avakian's earlier book, Through the Kitchen Window, where she talks about the fact that feminists, for the most part, rejected anything to do with food. You know, the second wave feminists, the early feminists, like they wanted out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so there was a real rejection there of anything food related, even scholarly. So Through the Kitchen Window was a few years prior to the Feminist Food Studies volume. So when I think about the trajectory, it kind of coincides with my own academic trajectory. I remember going to my very first meeting of Agriculture, Food and Human Values and the Association for the Study in Food and Society in Tuskegee in Alabama in 94 or 95. And I mean, there were presentations about maybe gender and food, but there was certainly no feminist food studies at that point. And, you know, coming fresh out of the CAVS assembly, I'm really struck by how far we've come in a really short time. And so I think feminist food studies is now also intersecting with queer studies, with Indigenous feminist food studies, with disability food studies, and MAD studies, and Black studies, and it just seems really exciting to me that the intersections continue to proliferate and just make it so much richer and more interesting and exciting and robust, I would say, and politically really vibrant and exciting.
I had the same feeling coming away from the 2025 CAFS conference that there was Alex Ketchum talking about the Queer Food Studies Conference that's now an annual event. And we were talking about Black food justice and on this podcast, you know, meat studies and how meat studies and vegan studies are perhaps two sides of the same coin, but relate to each other through food. And there's this incredible explosion of diversity. And that's perhaps the most normal thing for food studies to evolve towards. To me, when I think about these questions, it's often about countering the what I lump together as colonial masculist scientist, scientivism, positivism, the control and domination structuring of knowledge versus the relational and exchange and pluralistic structures of knowledge. Is that something that plays in any of your heads, or is that just me in my late night ramblings to myself about what's wrong with the world?
I'm not sure where to start with that. That's a really big sort of, it's a big picture piece, but within any feminist scholarship, the intention is to to not only critique structures of power and systems of power like colonialism or patriarchy or capitalism, but also I think those micro dynamics or those micro politics of food in this case are really important. You know, we talk about the diversity within feminist food studies, and certainly there's reason to explore any topic related to food through a feminist intersectional lens. Yeah, I think we learn and unlearn. There's such amazing scholarship coming from, you know, Black feminist writers in terms of food, Indigenous scholars theorizing food. So, you know, I think working together and learning and unlearning is a really important piece. I guess I just go back to sort of all of the interconnections when we think about food from a gendered perspective, because there are so many ways in which food is gendered, food practices are gendered.
Sure, yeah.
And really do structure our everyday lives. So even though, you know, food seems quite mundane, it's also so political and so socially relevant just in terms of everyday life and what's happening, you know, in terms of where we are now and where we've come from. Food is one of those places where we can come together and make connection and also care for one another. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I sort of brought us around to that idea of care, because I think now more than ever, you know, we can care and practice caring through food. I guess it's just really important when I think about where we are right now.
Care seems to be the thing, or empathy is the thing that we desperately need to continue practicing in order to move towards any kind of sustainable future of food, of society, of humanity more broadly. So fully agree with that.
I really appreciate, Barb, what you just said about care. The idea of care in, through, with food really strikes me as one of the key contributions of feminist food studies and moving from that 1970s second wave dismissal of food, running away from the kitchen. Food is so gendered, and it's such an important vehicle for us to express care and love for each other, but also for the planet and for the future. And so to me, food as care, food as love, feels like kind of the most important thing right now, as you said, David.
Yeah.
I don't see how we're going to get through without that. And without, you know, food is such a important kind of social glue and such an important way to reestablish connection with each other, but also in the other than human world as well. Like, we're in such a terrible state right now. And gender is kind of key to that. We look at the attacks on gender, but also the gendered nature of food as care, and that's been feminized and degraded. It always strikes me, it doesn't really matter what aspect of food, from, you know, production to consumption, except for the elite kitchens, restaurant kitchens, it's so degraded. Mm-hmm. The work is so invisible, and it's so unappreciated and undervalued and degraded, whether that's growing the food, picking the crops, processing it, selling it, preparing it at home. It continues to be, the labor that's involved in that continues to be not seen as important or valuable. And that feels like such an artifact of capitalism and patriarchy, where the things that are like vital to life, whether that's human or non-human life, it's so vital. We don't live without food. And it's been turned upside down. The valuing of it has been turned upside down.
For sure. And the mediatization, the politicization, the financialization of food, these are the ways that food gets valued in this more patriarchal framework of our societies. And yet I think you're coming back to care as the ontology of what food is perhaps a really important refocusing that we've been able to do in part through your work on this journal. I guess one last question for all of you is, in terms of the 7 years that have passed, in terms of the continued evolution that we've already mentioned about how food studies is growing and adapting and evolving and not separating into subcategories, but adding additional perspectives from all sorts of different worldviews, where do you think, if I can dare to ask you to speculate on the future of food and feminist studies or food and gender or everything that we've talked about, do you have any sense of where we can direct our attention?
I can add some thoughts there. And I think this kind of picks up on what Elaine and Barb were talking about with respect to care and empathy being so central to, I think, the when we're thinking about gender and food work, as well as feminist scholarship. And it kind of speaks to something that you mentioned in your question as well, is that feminist food studies may be seen as a sort of antithesis to sort of the scientization and sort of masculinist knowledge and positivism. But I think the future for me, or one of the exciting things about the emerging scholarship over the last few years, has been that it's bringing those things together. Mm. You know, different epistemological viewpoints of food studies, I don't think have been very well incorporated either by feminist scholarship in the past or by food studies scholarship. And as someone who has a background in both the sciences and the humanities and social sciences, I think a gap for me has always been not seeing those areas of knowledge as antithetical or as juxtaposed or as working across purposes. I think as long as we allow positivism to be done in sort of those masculinist sort of dominating sort of ways, then we allow it to continue that way. You know, I think a lot of feminist new materialist scholars have been embracing thinking about science in different ways. And for me, that is what's exciting. You know, science isn't necessarily patriarchal. It isn't necessarily capitalistic. We, I think, have in some ways allowed that to continue. I think it can be, but I think it's a tool that we can also use in thinking about advancing feminist scholarship broadly, but feminist food studies as well. Science is relevant to a lot of the wicked problems that both areas are, as interdisciplinary areas of scholarship, need to speak to or need to deal with.
Brilliantly said, because to reject science altogether is certainly not useful, but to bring it into a broader conversation with other perspectives and maybe to go back to a previous version of science that is not so co-opted by industry and corporations and politics. Barb, Elaine, any last thoughts on the future? Or are we just going to let your inspiring journal issue inspire other authors and we'll find out what the future of feminist food studies is in future issues of CFS?
I would actually just like to pick up on what you, David, and Jenna were just talking about. I was really inspired by the Queering Food Studies panel at CAFS in June and the idea of moving past binary thinking and the idea that, you know, for example, mm-hmm. that science, it's bad or it's good, or, you know, one or the other. It seems like a good example of that. So for me, that the future is a feminist queer food studies, however we put that together. And along with that, I think Indigenous feminist food studies, which also incorporates science, a different kind of science, you know, science that's really, it's a very much embodied and in placed kind of science, and it seems much more humble and much more in service of life than some forms of our current way of doing Western science.
Yes. Well, let's hope that those all come together. That sounds like a wonderful future. Barb, any last comments?
I guess I'm just picking up here and just thinking about, yeah, ontologies and worldviews and how when we think about intersectionality as a theoretical sort of framework to think about these things, I think we also have to just recognize that, you know, as Jenna, Elaine, you were saying, there are many different ontological ways that we can position our thinking and can learn. And that may mean unlearning as well, but learn from each other. And hopefully see kind of the fruits of that through feminist food studies. I think we could have a much longer conversation about this.
Oh, definitely. And thank you so much, though, for having this one right now and for spending the time, for helping us think through this question and also pick up the journal and read some of those wonderful, wonderful articles from 2018. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Liz Lovell is a community food systems coordinator with the Food Action Network of Northwestern Ontario and a recent master's graduate from Lakehead University. Having studied social ecological systems and sustainability in the Department of Health Sciences, they now focus professionally on community-led solutions, relationship building, and food self-determination.
My name is Liz Lovell, and I'm a master's student at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, which is located on the lands of Portland's First Nation. My degree is in health sciences with a specialization in social ecological systems, sustainability, and health. My thesis is a community-based participatory research project in partnership with Anambigusigiag and Anishinaabeg, the Thunder Bay District Health Unit, and the Understanding Our Food System project. And for my thesis, in partnership with AZA, I listened to the perspectives of elders, hunters, youth, and other food champions in the community to hear their experiences living and working on the land with respect to the impacts of environmental contaminants, specifically glyphosate. So I chose to read the article Waste Management as Food Work, a Feminist Food Studies Approach to Household Food Waste, written by Carly Frazier and Kate Parzo at the University of Guelph. So the concept of food waste caught my eye because of what I've been seeing in the news surrounding food waste recently. Because according to the United Nations, we produce more than enough food in the world to feed everyone living on the planet. And the fact that people are going hungry is directly tied to issues of access and distribution. So like Gabrielle Ferrero, who is the chair of the UN Committee on Food Security in 2002, actually said in an interview that we produce enough food to feed 1.5 times the global population. So it definitely sounds like an issue with distribution access. And so I just thought that this article would be interesting. I found in the article that it was interesting, also not surprising, that in food waste research, especially in the context of heterosexual couples, as they listed, women tend to be responsible for minimizing food waste in households. And in the Canadian context, women spend twice the amount of time cooking and cleaning than men do. So, of course, women have a much larger influence on what food waste is being produced in the home as the primary food provisioner. And I also hadn't thought of the relationship between sort of cooking skills, knowing how to cook with what's available, and what may have a timestamp on it, and how that relates to food waste. So that section sort of blew my mind wide open because I struggle with cooking, especially knowing how to use what's there, what's on sale, or what is about to turn bad. And in the context of the research I'm working on, there has been much food waste because of the abnormalities like community members are finding it with animals and also with plants and medicines. And community members have been unable to sort of harvest berries and medicines because of the glyphosate spraying. So a lot of what could be harvested goes unused. And it's also forced folks to have to travel farther to access food, for which, you know, there's no guarantee that just because you travel farther, you're going to find any food. So even after incurring high costs, you know, to travel to get food, there may not actually be any. And I also think that within the context of my research, maybe looking at things from a gender or feminist perspective in the future would be really beneficial, just to get a better understanding of different experiences within the community from different community members just based on gender. So after reading this article, I'm more interested now to see what more we could look at as far as food waste, especially from an Indigenous perspective, and also looking beyond just what's wasted in the kitchen or from table to so-called like garbage can. I really want to like be able to better understand food waste from a source perspective. For example, like in the context of environmental contaminants and hunting and gathering, you know, if animals and plants aren't being harvested because of abnormalities, like what's causing these abnormalities and like why is that happening? Because at the end of the day, if it can't be harvested and becomes a form of waste, it cannot be used and is left uneaten. I feel like in the context of food studies, we need to become more concerned with food waste management as a topic and contribute more to this research and studies on this topic in the future. And also, especially within the context of so-called Canada, because we waste a lot here.
Steph Chartrand is a PhD student in adult education and community development at OISE at the University of Toronto. A Métis researcher and community organizer, her work focuses on food work as relational, a set of processes for knowledge exchange, the shaping of identity, and the development and strengthening of community. In addition to her academic work, Steph is a board member with the Native Canadian Centre of Toronto.
Hi, my name is Steph Chartrand. I'm a Red River Métis and settler scholar from St. Laurent Métis community in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Currently, I'm a PhD student in Adult Education and Community Development at OISE, University of Toronto. My work is grounded in food studies and lifelong learning. I'm currently exploring how urban Indigenous folks engage with culinary aspects of their food systems and how those spaces become sites of resistance, learning, and relational care. When I'm not doing academic work, I volunteer as a board member with the Native Canadian Centre of Toronto. It's here where I learn how my academic work can have a real-life placement, and then how community actually informs better practices in academia. And I really enjoy this relationship between the two, which is exactly why I chose Leslie Frank's Finding Formula, as it's deeply relevant to my work in food studies, particularly in the context of urban Indigenous food sovereignty and relational food systems. The article helped me see how dominant narratives around food insecurity often leave out critical discussions such as infant feeding, even though it sits at the intersection of food access, care work, and policy, and these issues are relatable to the work I do. Because one of the most important ideas I took from the article was the way that formula access is framed not as a food justice issue only, but as a moral or maternal failure. This mirrors larger systemic patterns where state policy deflects responsibility by privatizing care and offloading it onto individuals, especially poor, racialized, or indigenous mothers. And this directly connects to my own interests in how state policy fails to uphold responsibilities to indigenous communities when care, land, or nourishment are not framed as capital producing. So the article has also helped me shift how I think about autonomy in food sovereignty. In food studies, we often emphasize, for a good reason, land, fresh food, traditional foodways. But Frank's work made me think critically about this idea of the right to choose and how when that choice is stigmatized or doesn't align with quote-unquote best practices that we might consider in academic space, it can be challenging. And for urban indigenous families, many of whom don't have access to land, this reframing is very crucial. It affirms that food sovereignty isn't only about what we grow or gather, but this idea of dignified access to food needs and how we survive and care for our kin and how we relate to one another. Finally, the reflections from frontline workers in the article echoed tensions I do see in community work as well. Like Frank's interviewees, I have seen how organizations must navigate restrictive funding structures or policy expectations, especially around food programming. And this relates to my work in the Friendship Center movement where, you know, staff and even myself working at a board level are caught between community needs, state-driven program criteria when you're looking into funding. It reinforced my commitment to advocating for relational, reflexive approaches that prioritize autonomy, cultural safety, and accountability in food systems. So for others engaging in this article, especially in food studies, I should suggest thinking about the quote-unquote ideal food narrative we often privilege in academia. When we fight for a better world, it needs to include space for different people to walk that path. So ask yourself, who decides what counts as food? Who is left out when policy focuses on quote-unquote best practices over real-life needs? And how our work supports food access that is not just nutritious, but just relational and culturally safe. Marseille, thank you for listening.
Having been formed as a feminist from a young age by the people and environments around me, I grew up thinking that the movement, the perspectives, and the patterns of interaction that feminism brings together were just, well, normal. Over time, I learned that that wasn't quite true, and also, through multiple processes of other socialization, I also learned to embody behaviors that really aren't that feminist. Like everyone, I guess, my reality is pretty intersectional. And I like to think that it's explicitly through intersectionality and pluralism that we can all find ways of connecting our ideas and our actions with each other so that more heterogeneous options can keep opening up, whether it's in academia, food practices, justice making, or any of the spaces we collectively occupy. Thank you very much to my delightful and diverse guests, Alexia Moyer, Jenna Brady, Barbara Parker, Elaine Power, Liz Lovell, and Steph Chartrand. Our inventive and interdisciplinary executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Check out the show notes for links to the publications mentioned in this episode and for a few more details about our guests and their work. Please also like and rate the show to increase its visibility, but also because our egos can always do with a little boost. Government leaders may deny that there's such a thing as intersectional feminism, preferring to pretend that the experience of women-identifying folks can be universalized or generalized. It's simpler that way, right? Sure, Jan. Really, it just makes it easier to pass legislation that controls people's bodies. While those in elected positions may continue to try to strip power from the people they are supposedly responsible to, we know what's what. And just as feminist and food scholars have broadened their understandings over time, so can they affect change in more governmental spaces. Just watch us.